Welcome to Artificially Intelligent Marketing, a weekly podcast where we stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, helping you get the best results from your marketing efforts. Now let's join our hosts, Paul Avery and Martin Broadhurst.
Welcome back to Artificially Intelligent Marketing, another day, another episode. I'm here as usual with Martin Broadhurst. Martin, how are you doing?
I'm great, looking forward to this after my week off. Great episode with Harrison, by the way. Lots of sharing of those clips on social media. I've got some great insights into how the sales piece is completely evolving and becoming this, well, it's a superpower, isn't it? If a rep has AI literacy at their fingertips, it really has changed the way that prospecting and sales works.
Yeah, I really took away from it the thoughtfulness required to do it well. Like, if you are not really putting the time and effort to really engage prospects effectively, and then you just scale that up, guess what? You're going to continue to not engage with prospects effectively. But if you really use this to augment your superpowers for making people care about your messages by understanding who they are, what they're likely to be interested in, other key triggers around their work and life that, you know, you might be able to use to make your message more relevant. So yeah, I also love Harrison loves a vibe code. So building out a bunch of tools for his team to use that have all been vibe coded. And I think because this is, we haven't even begun, we're on the tangents, but because vibe coding is just does not feel ready for the for prime time, instead of making a product you'd actually sell to people, it does feel like it's sort of early use cases of building things that are free for your team to use internally that you can make relatively safe in different ways, and that you're not charging anyone for, so that when it breaks, you don't have a bunch of irate customers and you're like, well, I don't know how to fix it because I didn't write it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the idea of making like little lead magnet style tools with it as well. I thought that was a nice little insight. Again, that's the kind of thing that I would be using Manus for. I think that's great for, you know, easy to deploy. You give it the instruction, you can put it live, got an app working. It's, you don't have to worry about any of the hosting. It's one click deployment. There's a lot to be said for vibe coding, but definitely not, I would say, in the production ready environment, particularly if you're deploying for a client.
And we missed you last week, and I'm guessing you were away because you were in the city of love, weren't you? You were in Paris.
I was, yeah. I was doing an AI seminar to a corporate client, and yeah, it was great. It was the interesting thing there was that the main takeaway for me from that audience was the industry that I was dealing with is saying, how do we make sure that we're across what AI is saying about our industry, and how do we get involved in the conversation? SEO is a well-known playbook. PR is a kind of well-known playbook, but AIO is new. And I think there's a lot of reputation management questions. I would probably frame it as that, where people are wondering how are they going to be involved in the conversation in the same way.
Your opinion on AIAIO or AGO, AEO, AIO, GEO. What's your opinion on all of these mechanisms? Catch-alls for, we need to make sure that our brand is shown up in generative search results, whether that be Google's version or when people are using ChatGPT. What are your thoughts?
I don't think it's a million miles away from previous playbooks. It's write good content and distribute it. I think if you're writing content and it's sitting in one little corner of the internet, the AI bots, crawlers, models, whatever it may be, will have a hard time finding it. Whereas if you're producing content, you're sharing it, you've got good distribution on blogs, podcasts, white papers, things like that, and you're being picked up in reputable sources, well, I think the AI crawlers, the bots, the language models will find it more easily. And then it comes down to structuring the content as well? How do you make sure that you're writing content that is optimized for AI models? It's going to be a similar thing. It's about making sure that it reads well. You've not got big walls of text. You've got sections that are clearly demarked and kind of delineated, with almost like thinking about your kind of metadata, thinking about, you know, structuring your content properly. Still has to be human readable, but things like bullet points are going to be important on web copy still. I don't think a lot's changed, if I'm completely honest. It's just what becomes a ranking factor, in my opinion, is the big thing that's going to change. There's an algorithm that people have always been working to for Google. Now people are going to be trying to work out what the algorithm or equivalent is for search AI.
Yeah, it's, I've been having a bit of an AI existential crisis last week. We talked about it a bit off air, and we're going to talk about it in a different section of the show, which we'll start properly in a minute, dear listener, I promise. But this is one of those areas where I can't decide if this is something that people should be thinking about, worrying about, and investing a lot of time and energy in. I'm sure there will be a time when that is true, but is it now? Or is it FOMO-driven gold rush, where all of the SEO software companies are like, oh no, we haven't got a business model anymore. We need to create a thing that we can now have a business model around. So if you're SEMrush or whoever, and people are not going to necessarily care so much about tracking keywords potentially if everything's being answered at the top of a Google search, which isn't the case, by the way, but if that were the case. And then there's people crawling out the woodwork with these like 15-step plans to help you get featured in, you know, ChatGPT search results, which I think is either a mixture of good practice for SEO and content marketing in general, or usually stuff with a bit of rubbish that they don't have any evidence that actually works. It just sounds like it probably would. And they probably asked ChatGPT to tell them what to do and see if it could work. And then I saw another post on LinkedIn this week about the very small fraction of searches that of traffic that's still coming from ChatGPT, Perplexity. And when you look at your overall marketing mix, how should you apportion effort in a balanced way based on, you know, the contribution of different sources to your marketing results? So is it the time to go running after this? I'm not sure. Thoughts, Martin?
I think there's a lot of that, certainly in the SEO industry, where SaaS providers or SEO tools are saying, this is the most important thing. You've got to track these keywords. And now all of a sudden you can't do that. You've got to come up with this new, you know, let's be honest, there's always been an element of skepticism about how valid SEO strategies were. People have had bad experiences, fingers burnt with SEO. I know it's legit. I'm not downplaying SEO, but it's been seen as a bit of a dark art for many a year. I think we're in that stage with AI, and the nature of the language models poses a real threat to an industry where there has been, you know, Google's always had personalization in the results. People have been aware of that for a while, but for a long time, the organic results were generally fairly consistent amongst searches, and you could track that. I just don't think you're going to be able to do that with AI at any meaningful sense. And that's just because of the way that the models work. If I have a fresh, clean, OpenAI account, ChatGPT, it's got no memory of me, it's got no custom instructions, it's just me putting in a search, and then you do the same thing with a fresh account, then sure, yeah, it's comparing apples with apples. But if I've got a chat history with it, and it's got memory, and it's got custom instructions and personalization and details, that wildly skews how the model works. And I don't understand how you can try to optimize for that kind of experience. Hence my previous comment being about, I think if you just take the approach that good classic content marketing, good marketing principles are what you should be focusing on, rather than obsessing about what that means for your visibility in ChatGPT, Perplexity and other sources, you'll probably do just fine.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. So I'll go into ChatGPT and I'll try and mimic what I think our customers are searching for. And in a weird way, in old school Google search, that was actually reasonably easy because you're like, you're betting that usually someone's going to type in 2 to 8 words max as their search string, and they're probably going to use the top level bucket, like in our case, best life science marketing agency or something. And then they're just going to scan the results to see, you know, which of those blue links are the ones they want to click. I think the people who are using AI to answer these types of questions or even doing deep research have probably got enough exposure to using the tools to have, what, a 50-word prompt, like maybe outlining some context about the type of business they are, the markets they want to grow in, what types of products they sell, which is going to massively influence the answer, right? Like, maybe best life science marketing agency is not something anybody would ever put into ChatGPT. Maybe they're like, I'm a company, I sell microscopes into research labs and diagnostic pathology labs, mostly targeting North America. That is, you know, that's probably going to give you quite a different answer than your standard keyword string that you would have optimized for as part of SEO. So I think that's the other thing that just makes it really, really hard. Like, what are you tracking? Like, nobody knows how often your brand's showing up in these results. I just don't think those tools really work very well from what I can see so far, just because the nature of how people search is and use ChatGPT is very different.
The information that you can get at a macro level about insights into the phrases and the queries and the prompts that people are using is incredibly limited. There's virtually nothing. The way that people use these chatbots is very, very general and versatile. And there's a lot of stuff, you know, we hear about people using it as therapy and things like that. Very personal stuff can be shared with them. So it's in the interest of the model providers to never share any significant detail about keywords and terms and things like that. Now, that might change if they move with an advertising model in the future and they'll give you some broad topics that you can target on. But at the moment, we don't have any insight at all, other than I think it was been 2 papers published, by one by Anthropic and one by OpenAI, into the kinds of uses that people have for large language models. And that's at a very, very, really high category level, you know, not getting into any kind of specific keywords, industry terms or anything like that. So, yeah, I think anyone that's offering a tool to shine a light on this is at the moment, I would be very skeptical about the value of such a thing.
I agree. I think where I end up coming back to with all of this is there's very few free lunches in marketing. Even SEO, which feels like free traffic in inverted commas, you have to create the content, you have to, you know, gather the backlinks, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not really free. It takes resources, time and effort. And what you see with most platforms, Google search included, but certainly social platforms, is there starts off with a bit of a free lunch and then very quickly you have to pay to reach the people that you want to reach. So again, like investing loads of time and effort in trying to buy a platform to track my mentions in AI searches and try and monetize that to make sure I'm attracting traffic that's turning into customers, or just pay for ads to reach people that I know are looking for a product like mine. Like, I think I know where I would start. So yeah, that's just been on my mind this week. But a few things on my mind this week, Martin. But let's talk about what we're actually going to talk about this week, which is not just what's been on my mind, but what's actually been happening in the news. So we've got a few things we're going to cover up. We're going to talk about a bunch of launches from Anthropic. We're going to talk about Claude integrating into Microsoft 365. We're going to be looking at some stuff from Google AI Studio. Rumors about Gemini 3 abound. I saw there was some potential Gemini 3 models in Ella Marina this morning. So maybe we can talk about that as well. We've obviously got Veo 3.1. Video continues to get better and better. And then you spotted a really interesting thing that the UK government has launched. So we're going to go through all of those and we'll talk about some of the other things that were on our mind last week as well. Why don't we start with some of Anthropic's launches this week, Martin? What have they been up to?
Anthropic have had a busy couple of weeks. They've launched Haiku 4.5, which is their cheap, fast, and pretty good model. It's part of their suite of models alongside Opus and Sonnet. And they've launched this to run at 2.5 times faster than Sonnet 4.5. It's a third of the cost if you're using the API. And its ability to achieve incredible results, particularly at the coding use case, is really quite remarkable. It's achieved very high scores on the SWE benchmark, which is a software engineering benchmark. And it's performed really well alongside the GPT-5s and Sonnet 4.5s of this world. So that's quite an exciting one. I think if anyone is using Claude and Claude Code in particular, switching to the Haiku model, particularly if you're using a task that's going to be quite long in context, will enable you to go quite far in the conversation. I think the quality of the outputs, I've only had a small play with it, but everything I've seen so far is very good. I'm not talking from a software engineering perspective. I'm just talking kind of day-to-day use cases. It did a really good job with one of my kind of standard benchmark tests, which is getting it to use MCP across a bunch of different tools and execute a few tasks for me. So yeah, I think that's a great launch. As well as that, they announced Claude Skills. Now, this is where you can, in essence, you can write standard operating procedures, much like you would for members of your team, saying, this is how we operate within our organization. We do this, then we do this, then we do this, and these are the tools we use. You can write these documents and provide that to Claude. And Claude will then have that as a skill available for it to reference. Interestingly, they've published some of their own skills internally at Anthropic. So they've got skills like creating a Word doc, and it's an outline about how to actually create Word docs. But you can do it for all sorts of things, and you can integrate with MCP as well. So this skill can advise on how Claude can connect to the other tools that you use, whether it's CRM, databases, or whatever it may be. So this is quite an interesting development. And I can see in the future, based on just a couple of clues that were in the way that Claude published their skills, I can imagine a world where skills become, or there is a marketplace for skills, where you as a Claude user can create a skill and then say, other people will find this useful. I'm going to publish this skill and share it in the Claude marketplace, even potentially having paid for skills. And the reason I say that is in the licensing of the skills that Anthropic published on GitHub, some of them were released with Apache 2 license, which can be other people can use it and share it. Some of them were locked down, copyright owned by Anthropic, and this is not to be reproduced. So that's an interesting potential development that we might see in the future. And I think if you're working in a marketing team or an organization looking to deploy agents, keeping an eye out for the development of skills could be definitely one to watch in the future.
I think it's quite interesting that on the one hand, AI tools make it easier for you to deploy code-based solutions, even if you're not a developer, right? But I do get the sense that Anthropic are very much serving the coding and developer community more than anyone else, because, you know, even just having these skills up on GitHub already tells you who the audience is, because I'm not sure the average marketer's that familiar with GitHub and knows how to get files off GitHub and use them themselves. And, you know, this is not there's no skill store where you can create a skill add it to the store and people can search for it and find it and easily install it in their own instance, which would almost certainly make it easier for your average user to engage with this. But if your primary audience is developers, throwing something up on GitHub is a pretty handy way to give people rapid access, because that's the community that's very used to working like that. So yeah, it's one of them. I want to see a little bit more business or marketer sort of built solutions really from Anthropic.
Interesting that you say that, because there is no skill store yet, that they have announced a deeper integration with Microsoft 365 suite of tools. And this is where the applied business use case, maybe moving away from kind of developer community, starts to come into play. There was an announcement recently where some of the frontier agents within Microsoft 365 Copilot Pro license could be used with Anthropic. So you could use the Claude models instead of the GPT-5. And that was an announcement that came a few weeks ago. Well, that partnership between Microsoft and Claude is extending, where people with Claude licenses can now connect to Microsoft 365 and use Claude connected to SharePoint, Outlook, OneDrive, Teams, which obviously opens up a huge amount of context and applications for using Claude as an assistant in a business context. Now, when you think about that alongside the potential for skills, so you've launched some skills, you're saying, this is how we do things. We go to a SharePoint site, we find the latest entry on a SharePoint list, we retrieve that, we send the document to this person. Maybe you've got MCP connected and it runs an approval flow, and it brings back new documents, collates stuff, builds a report, drops it in another SharePoint folder. All of a sudden, you can start to see how we're very nascent in its development. You know, it still pretty much feels like day one, but I can start to see where it's heading and how these disparate elements are beginning to converge in what is the start of interesting agentic assistance.
Yeah, I guess it was always going to be a bit fragmented as we figure out what works well and what doesn't. Like, it doesn't make sense for Anthropic to invest a load of money in building out a really plush consumer-facing platform for connecting skills and agent capabilities if this doesn't end up being the route that gives us reliable agentic capabilities. I think we end up also seeing a lot of experiments in the wild done by these companies in terms of, you know, this might only exist in its current form for 6 months and then it changes into something else or completely disappears because actually nobody used it because it didn't work very well, or maybe it was amazing and people would never consider using an AI tool without some sort of skills repository, and then of course it goes in a different direction. So I think it's also quite interesting when you look at the new Haiku model and its capabilities and then the addition of skills and just trying to climb up this mountain of capability to get to something reliable, cheap and fast. And it's just, I think it's good to stay on top of how these models are changing because of what you can then start to do with them. So yeah, Anthropic did some interesting stuff last week. And yeah, and obviously that little bit with Microsoft is Microsoft spreading its bets, not being so much of a open AI house, and Claude doing its best to reach, or Anthropic, I should say, reach new users through other people's distribution networks, in essence.
Yeah, I think the partnership between Microsoft and OpenAI is evolving, and we're seeing new partnerships emerge on all sides. So Anthropic partnership with Microsoft and OpenAI partnering with other cloud providers, moving away from being so reliant on Azure. Yeah, it's all change.
Let's move on to some of the bits and pieces that we saw from Google this week. Martin, maybe we start with Veo 3.1. Sora 2 video capabilities come out from OpenAI, and within like pretty much a week, Google's like, we've been working on this stuff too. Look, have you had a chance to play with AO 3.1 at all?
I haven't, but I've watched some of the trails and seen some of the capabilities. And yeah, I think they've done a really good job. So what does it do? Well, it expands what you can do with Veo 3.0 is taking it on. You can now generate videos using first and last frames. You can make videos with up to 3 reference images as well to help steer the video creation. And the audio capabilities have improved. Without testing this in the wild, it's hard to say. Interestingly, they did also announce developments to the Flow tool. Now, I don't know if you've used Flow, but I think this is something that people are sleeping on. Flow is actually a video storyboarding tool, and you can piece together lots of different clips. Now, the back-end engine is Veo, and you can input your images as and then prompt it, and it will create the clip you want to create. So where you want something with lots of cutscenes and you actually want to create a full-length video, whether it's a couple of minutes long, you can do that all within this one editor. I've had a play with it myself. It's been out for a while now. I really enjoy it. I got to grips with it in about 30 minutes, and I've used it for some personal projects, but also used it just to showcase its capabilities to some clients. And I think one of those tools where in the hands of a creative, incredibly powerful. In the hands of someone like me, just kind of fun. But yeah,
there's a couple of things I'm really interested to see with what happens with video as we sort of, as we see it, the tools sort of evolve, is for brands running that risk between using AI for video, perhaps for TV spots or for like video ads on YouTube. And how they approach that in terms of we don't pay creatives anymore, we use AI, right? So you could get that sort of backlash. The other thing is there are still some telltales, I think, in a lot of the generations that you can see it's probably AI, like the speech and the doesn't sound quite human. I can't explain it, just like the speech patterns. A lot of it seems like hurried. I can't describe it. It's like the characters in these AI generated videos can't wait for to speak or for the other person to stop speaking so they can go, oh, do, 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 do. Do you know what I mean? And then that also makes me wonder if, you know how like when you're using ChatGPT and it loves an N dash, and then it developed this need to always go, oh, it's not this, it's this. I wonder if we're going to see those types of patterns emerge in AI generated video, where there'll be just certain types of cuts or certain types of scene compositions that are clearly very AI generated, which will then just make everything feel a bit average and the same if they get overused. And the classic one for me, it's less so now with Sora 2 and Veo 3.1, but with a lot of the early video models, the best that the videos could really handle was like a slow pan. So like you'd see 5-second video where there was a character sort of slightly moving as the camera panned. Yeah. And then the next 5 seconds was exactly the same, but from a slightly different angle, because, you know, animating characters in a physical world is hard, but panning across a fairly static character is not so hard. So I don't know, what would you advise to a company, Martin, who are thinking, yeah, I'm going to jump on this, I'm going to start producing AI videos, and we're going to start pushing them out on LinkedIn ads or whatever?
Well, first of all, it strikes me that the two companies are taking quite different approaches. So OpenAI with Sora and releasing that effectively as a social network. That's what it is. It's a social network where you've got unbounded creativity, if you want to call it that. You've got unrestricted access to these videos that can be created from just text. And that leads to all sorts of interesting and wonderful creations. But there's very limited control over the generation itself. And that's where Flow differs. So Google have taken this different approach, which does seem more geared towards creatives and producers, and maybe even businesses as well, and creative teams, where yes, you're using AI to generate some snippets, but you can add your own content into the timeline as well. You have much more control over the clips that it uses. And you can, if the AI generates an 80-second clip, you can trim that down. You have more control over the final output. So it's much more of a collaborative, not even a collaborative tool. It's a tool that you use to create the output, and AI is just an ingredient into the video. So yeah, that's, I think if you're a business wanting to get started with AI tools, check out Flow. It's included as part of the Google Workspace for Business toolkit. And you get a limited number of VO generations included in that.
I guess where I'm going with this is, if you can produce these videos, but some of them still look a little bit crappy, or there does turn out to be these patterns which scream AI in the edit, in, you know, in the cuts and what have you, and how scenes are framed, I think certainly for mid-sized brands and above, you might have to think a bit more carefully about how you're going to use it and how you're going to deploy it. I'm like, what is the point? Yeah.
Well, I think that's where the flow is different. With Flow, it's you have all that control. So where it has these scenes that have the, like with Sora, you get an output, you put in a prompt, you get an output, that's your video. With Flow, if it's got those cuts and those scenes, you just trim that off. Like, you're still producing the video. So if you're putting out crappy, evidently AI, like quite clearly AI generated content, that's on you.
I think that's the key. So what you're saying then is it's the equivalent of writing a blog post in ChatGPT and uploading it without any edits or thought, just doing things at speed. But actually with Flow, you've got the control to actually bring some human control, creativity, ingenuity to actually make it good.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the key piece, isn't it? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And like we've said on previous podcast episodes, as the tools get better, the differentiator is still your original interesting idea and having something interesting to say that your audience is going to care about, and how you can use video to elevate that and make it more memorable, or make it resonate more, or make it easier to disseminate the information you're trying to disseminate, because maybe it works better in video than it would in, say, text. I think that's the one thing that's always on my mind. I mean, depending on your brand and the market you operate in, I think the easiest opportunity, and we've seen this a lot already, is humor, right? It's almost like if you lean into some of the sort of nuances of the tools and where they are quite low capability, or you find a way of entertaining people so they don't really care that it's a bit, well, that bit looked a bit weird, or a human would never speak like that, then I think you get a lot more flexibility from the audience. Whereas if you try to do like a very serious explainer video that's got a weird talking lead who's like barking at you because they can't wait to speak quickly, then maybe that's not the way forward. Cool. Some other bits from Google this week as well. We had the AI studio unifying its playground and putting all of its tools in one place. Do you use Playground a lot in AI Studio?
I use AI Studio quite a bit, particularly when I'm workshopping. And I think it's been quite challenging to show it off to newcomers to the space. So I'll show people all of these interesting tools. You go to AI Studio, and you know, AI Studio is great just because the limits, like you can generate things for free. You don't need a subscription. You get access to top models like Gemini 2.5 Pro, and people are very excited about being able to use that for free. Obviously, when something is free, you are the product, but let's not dwell on that for too long. But when you're showing off AI Studio to a room full of keen novices, it's quite confusing. You need things linked to a project in a Google Cloud platform. You need to generate API keys to use certain tools, and the API key management is confusing. And even as someone who has been using these tools for a while, I find it a bit much. So the fact that they've addressed this and everything, all of the models are now in one place. They've simplified the API key usage and deployment. I think that can only be a good thing for adoption, because at the end of the day, Google has really good models.
Yeah, I think it's great that people who haven't got paid access to these tools can go try the most capable tools. So if you haven't heard of it and you don't have paid Google account and you're interested to know how does it compare to the other tools you're using, I think that's good. It's also nice that a little bit like OpenAI's playground, you can modify some of the underlying settings that are driving the model's output. So you can change what's called the temperature, which it's probably a bad analogy, but it's like almost like the creativity dial to a certain extent in terms of the randomness of the outputs. I think it's useful if you're a marketer to have a knowledge of this and access to this, because there'll be use cases where you want more creative expression or you want different ideas from the tool. And there'll be times when you need it to be extremely consistent, or at least as consistent as a large language model can be, where then you might want a really low temperature setting, like, I don't know, a customer service agent that drafts email responses to common customer complaints based on a knowledge base, where actually you don't want it going off the deep end very often. You probably just want to lean into the RAG knowledge base. So yeah, I think I'll go and have a play with it. The thing that I mostly want to play with is Veo 3.1, to be honest. So when I get a moment, that's probably what I'm going to go and play with next.
Before we move on from that story, I just want to say, in an email this week, they trailed something that I think might just make an appearance on our next episode. So in that Google AI Studio email this week, they said this week was about building a better foundation. Next week, we're going to build something magical on top of it. Get ready for Zero to Magic Week, where we'll introduce a new way for you to go from a single idea to a working AI-powered app faster than we ever thought possible.
Sounds very vibe codey, but without the coding.
Doesn't it just? Yeah. So they've already got Firebase, where you can vibe code an app and deploy it, and it will actually generate the API keys. It can do text to speech, speech to text. It has all of that capability in it because it has all of the models from the Google Vertex suite. I wonder whether they've seen enough real world applications of people building in Firebase that they're now going to roll that out into a specific app that might be competing with the likes of Manus, Replit, and various other vibe codey providers.
Interesting. Right, last story this week is some actions being taken by the UK government and their One Big Thing initiative. This caught your eye, Martin. Tell the listeners about it.
Yeah, so this is an announcement, which is One Big Thing 2025 AI for All, and it's a national initiative to help all civil servants gain confidence and competence in using AI responsibly in their roles. So research had revealed that only 28% of civil servants felt comfortable and confident using AI at work, which has prompted this year of building the foundational knowledge, really raising the level of AI literacy amongst the civil service. So at the heart, they talk about the program aiming to improve understanding of how AI enhances public service delivery, encourage responsible and ethical use of tools, and share examples, real-world examples of effective AI adoption within and beyond the government. So civil servants can access 4 15-minute learning modules through the civil service learning alongside departmental activities, discussions, case studies, expert sessions, and things like that. And this comes alongside other AI applications already in use across the UK government. So gov.uk has a chatbot, which is improving access to government information across 700,000 pages, which has been preferred by users internally over traditional search. Education, so they've got AI models trained on curated educational content, and it's touted as achieving 92% accuracy. Now, when I hear that kind of a number, the first thing I think of is it's wrong 8 out of 100 times, and at scale, that makes it completely unreliable. But anyway, we'll gloss over that for now. In healthcare, there's a major breast cancer screening trial using AI tools across 700,000 participants and lots of other activities as well. But the main thing for me is this idea that there's a real concerted effort within the government now to raise AI foundational knowledge and raise that literacy. I think this comes off the back of a pilot study last year where civil servants were given access to chat assistants. I think it was Microsoft Copilot they were given access to. There were mixed results in terms of overall productivity gains, but it was thought that having access to something like Copilot will save the typical civil servant 2 weeks per year in their workload. And interestingly, at the end of the study, I think it was 82% of respondents said they would like to continue having access to the assistants, which is a pretty strong endorsement for having access to AI assistants.
I've got some questions for you about this, Martin. And I think it's probably quite a handy segue into, I want to get your feeling for what does AI training look like done well? You've done lots of training. You've got the UK government now thinking about upskilling a large group of people, probably from diverse backgrounds, diverse age groups, and with diverse set of roles. So I guess one question would be, in your experience, is it better to have like one set of AI training for everybody, regardless of all of those things? Or is it better to customize the AI training? And if so, how?
I strongly believe that the baseline information is applicable to everyone. So one set of standardized training to begin with, and then you move into the almost the function specific training. But at its base level, people need to understand what this generative AI thing is. That's separate from the tools, so not getting too deep into Copilot or ChatGPT, but I think when people understand what large language models are, the very basics of how they work, not getting lost in the weeds on, you know, tokens and reinforcement learning and what have you, but just an explainer of what it is and what it isn't, I think is really helpful, because ultimately this is a new software paradigm. And when people are very familiar with Google search and the way that Excel works and how calculators work, and everything's fairly predictable, and then suddenly you've got this new thing that kind of looks like magic and makes people go, "Ooh, wow," then you need to make it clear to them that this isn't what was before, that this is new. And then once people understand what it is, you can start getting into the specific applications for them, for their function, and how it can help them in their role. But the other thing I think is quite important with this is giving people the confidence to experiment. Most of the gains at this moment in time that we see for AI transformation within organizations comes at the individual employee level. We're not seeing agentic workflows completely taking over companies yet. Now, that may well happen in the not too distant future, but right now, if organizations can help people do more slightly faster and give people the permission to use, say, Copilot as the approved model, then people will find their own use cases, because people are kind of interested in their own workflows and they'll find the shortcuts that can help make them work better. Unfortunately, some of that will involve producing AI work slop.
Yeah, I think that's a critical part of the training, is it's actually critical analysis training for people to make sure they're really paying attention to to the outputs that they're getting. And I think it will also therefore be critical to make sure people truly understand, as you said earlier, what the tools are good at, what they're good at but need a lot of checking, and what they're bad at to the point where maybe you should just do it manually. Like, I still struggle with doing data, like any important data analysis in these tools. I'd want to do it myself, just because all it takes is one error to creep in, and then you've just reported something to your boss or the board or whoever that actually turned out to be wrong. And then that might live on for a year because nobody goes and checks it, and it's like, oh, that turned out to be a piece of data that was incorrect, or an assumption that was incorrect because we didn't check the output. So I think that becomes critical. What do you think about the tools that people already have access to? Is it critical that everybody has access to ChatGPT, or Copilot, or do you just get them started on the free tools? What does that look like?
I think first and foremost, every organization needs to give one tool, whatever it is, at least one tool. The easiest one for organizations to go with is the one that comes bundled with your Office productivity suite. So if you're a Microsoft 365 environment, give them Copilot 365 chat. It's free. It doesn't have grounded knowledge in the kind of SharePoint and enterprise information, but it's got web grounding. You can upload files, so people can upload files from their OneDrive and ask it questions about that, but they can't send it off to go and look on SharePoint and retrieve information from there. So it's not grounded in that, but it's still really useful. It's better than people using the free version of ChatGPT, which is going to train the model on data going forward. Likewise, if you're in the Google Workspace environment, use Gemini. It's included and it's bundled in. So I would say, first and foremost, businesses need to provide access, because if they don't, you're going to end up with the shadow IT system. We see this happening already, where people don't get access to a chatbot. IT might be a bit scared of deploying it, so they don't. And then what do people do? They'll email themselves a file, they'll upload it on their phone to a ChatGPT app that they've got, and then they just copy and paste the responses back. So, you know, people will find workarounds. You're much better off giving people an approved method and saying, get started with the free version. And if you have a use case or requirement for the pro license, the upgraded license, then come and speak to us and pitch that business case.
Last question, and then I'll promise I'll leave you alone. I've been thinking about the differences between the training and actually having people embed this in the way they work. I'd love to get your take on the difference between one and done training and true change management to help people gain that confidence and adopt these tools. What are your views on that?
Yeah, that's a really important question. Because what you'll see is, if you do one and done training, is you see people that are enthusiastic and want to go away and play with it, and they'll naturally lean into it, whereas other people will basically turn up for the training and never return to it again. But this is where I think it needs to be looked at the functional level. So you deploy the basic foundational training and say to everybody, here's the standard of AI literacy. This is what prompting looks like. These are the tools that you can use. These are the guardrails that we need to put in place. These are the caveats regarding what it can and can't do, and your responsibility for handling the outputs, et cetera, et cetera. Once everybody's kind of comfortable with that, I think the next place for innovation and change comes at the functional level. So what are the tasks within a particular function, whether it's HR employee onboarding or, handover from sales to operations? You find these workflows to start to bring in automations, or to bring in agent assistants that are grounded in knowledge related to that task or that function. And that's where you start to get that change management piece adopted, because it becomes more, it's less about the individual, but somebody can take, you're looking at this systematically. You still need someone driving this. You'll need, like any project of this kind of scale, you'll need champions, you'll need your racing matrix, all of that kind of stuff. But when you start to look at how it impacts multiple touch points and entire processes, that's where larger impact will come in.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of benefit to having those champions and to organize working groups that might, you know, you might meet once a month and discuss, oh, there's a new model out and now that workflow that we used to run is much better. So if you stop using it because the output's kind of sucked, actually the newest version of the model now gives you much better outputs. Or, oh, I've improved this prompt, so give this new prompt to try for this particular task.
Well, I heard an example recently. I was working with one client and they've deployed Copilot. Everybody's got Copilot 365 chat, the free version, and they've got a small working group with Copilot 365 Pro for some of the senior management and a few managers within the organization. But there's been no support around that. What's happening is the IT team is effectively forwarding emails from Microsoft whenever there is an announcement. Now, I don't know if you're paying a great deal of attention to the minutiae of updates and product launches in Copilot, but it's a high volume and it's frequent. There is lots of changes and adjustments and new capabilities all the time. So if there's no central coordinating body saying, how does this impact us? Even if it's a quarterly update, you know, it's the what would you call it? The AI council within your organization that says, okay, there have been these updates. It's out of beta. It's a released model or workflow or application. What can we do with this? I think a lot of it will pass organizations by and there'll be tools that are at their disposal that they just won't know or have the capacity to play with.
Yeah, that'll be the classic. I think that's been the classic of all enterprise software ever, anywhere. I mean, you see a lot of HubSpot installations. How many people are using even half of what HubSpot can do effectively? Almost no one, probably.
And it's the same. I mean, that you mentioned HubSpot. They've just announced Breeze agents and Breeze assistants. It's the same thing with that. I mean, the pace of development is massive. It's hard enough to stay on top of it when you're a partner and you're getting all of the updates. So the end users, yeah, they'll be missing the bulk of that.
Alrighty, well, that was a good topic to cover at the end. There is anything else you want to talk about before we sign out from this episode, Martin?
Just before we go, I just want to say, did you see the clip of Boris Johnson talking about AI this week?
I've not watched it. I saw it come up in one of my feeds. go on. I'm prepared.
Taking it back to the idea of giving AI to people without a grounding in what it is, what it can do, and all of that. He talks about ChatGPT and it being brilliant and it has all of these capabilities. But one of the things he really hones in on, and you can see really plays to his personality, is the sycophancy of the model. Because he says, oh, and it tells you that's a great question. And it says to you, oh, such an insight that you've brought there. It's fantastic. He really likes the sycophancy of the model.
Well, no comment on that. Any other thing on my mind is I don't know if I should have done this to myself. I'm trying to give myself as many different viewpoints on AI as I can so that I don't get caught in an AI fanboy club that we are kind of in. So I listened to a couple, and one of them was with Andre Karpathy. It was on the Dvorkesh podcast. People who listen to podcasts probably know who Karpathy is. Very well respected researcher, used to work at OpenAI and at Tesla. Now invests most of his time in actually trying to teach people about how AI works and inspire people to build tools with AI. And he's creating a teaching platform for lots of different things. But of course, he started where he knew. So if you want to know how AI tools, large language models are built, he has some fantastic videos. Anyway, over the course of about 2 hours, he managed to reduce my enthusiasm for the impact of AI in the short to midterm quite significantly. One key quote that been bandied about a lot already on the socials, mostly out of context, is that AGI is 10 years away. One of the things he does is he goes back to the original definition of AGI, which is like a computer that can do anything as well as a human, which means in the real world, not just on, you know, on a digital surface. But even amongst that, you know, he, as much as he's really impressed with the improvement in coding tools, he still mostly uses the autocomplete feature. He's writing the code himself. He's using it to like finish lines of code, but he's not like vibe coding particularly with it. So I don't know. Can you, maybe you can help me, Martin. Is there a lot of, is there really a big bubble here and everyone's way too enthusiastic? And if we actually step out of the system for a second, does AI kind of suck or is it still very powerful and usable tool in your hands?
So the podcasting question was fascinating because he spoke about not using it for coding, and the kind of coding that he is doing is real leading edge stuff, right? He's creating new things. He's working in, he's building something from nothing. Whereas I think probably a lot of programmers are using existing frameworks. They're building applications that use fairly well-known programming languages and what have you, and they'll still get a lot of value from that. That said, I think the level of existing AI model capability has still has, even if the models, we said this a year ago, I think, even if the models get no better from where they are today, there is still huge potential to apply them in existing work environments. It just requires building out new workflows, new processes to handle information. The models are going to get better. Now, there's a, on the flip side of that, is the current AI hype valuation justified? I don't know. Depends who you listen to. Listening to Karpathy? No. Listening to Sam Altman? Yes, and more. I don't think I have an insight, but right now, what I can say is that the current technology and where it's at is underutilized, and there's still huge amounts of value to be garnered from deploying it in very precise ways.
Yeah, I think when I was thinking about my own work and using AI and where it adds value and where it doesn't, I guess the thing that I end up the most disappointed in is how much steering is still required and how much review and validation and improvement of the outputs, which of course is great because it keeps me in the job. But I don't think that part of it has actually improved that quickly relative to some of the other leaps that we're seeing. I don't know if it comes down to fundamental hallucination rates and error rates still being a problem, or whether it's as a human in my role with X many years experience doing what I do, I have so much stored context in my brain that I could never communicate in a, certainly in a single chat, but probably not over a year's worth of chats, as I am basically using a tool that has, you know, one eye shut and one arm tied behind its back, because it just doesn't know all the things that I know, and I can't communicate them because it's, you know, how would you, sometimes you don't even know that you know that and the machine doesn't until you get an output and you're like, oh, well, no, obviously not that. Why have you gone down that route? And it's because it's obvious to you because it's in your brain. So, yeah, I think I'm still getting a lot of value is the truth, but it's just, I think its ability to really produce like high quality things without lots of steering is still probably my biggest frustration.
That's the assistant though, isn't it? That's the AI chat scenario.
100%. Yeah. I'm not really building much in with MCP. I know our team have built some really interesting and robust things, and so I'm very much speaking for my own use cases here. Across our team, people are doing incredible things and building with lots of more sophisticated tools because they're data scientists and developers and I'm not, right? I try and see myself as the average marketer who goes into Gemini or goes into ChatGPT to get help with content strategy, content creation, planning a campaign and those types of things. And I guess if you are that and you're listening and you're thinking, yeah, I still think I do most of, if not all of the thinking and hard work, I would think you're probably right, because that's how I feel. Well, on that note, dear listener, thank you for joining us for another hour. Martin, thank you for your insights as usual. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Bit soon.
Thank you for listening to Artificially Intelligent Marketing. To stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, be sure to subscribe. We look forward to seeing you again next week.